Psychologists actually have started calling ugly people those with severe appearance deficits. And we have no more old people in this country. No more old people. We shipped them all away, and we brought in these senior citizens. As soon as I was in my 40s, I'd look in the mirror and I'd say, well, I guess I'm getting older. Older sounds a little better than old, doesn't it? Sounds like it might even last a little longer. Thanks to our fear of death in this country, I won't have to die. I'll pass away.
And you're listening to George Carlin, who on this day in history did pass away. Actually, he died. In his honor, we're going to say that. And that happened in 2008. And whatever you think of Carlin's political views, and by the way, to put him in a box, you better just be careful. Because conservatives, liberals, and independents all at some point or another were offended by George Carlin. And that was the point. And if anything, you could just simply call him anti-authoritarian. Because in the end, he didn't like any authority. And by the way, there's a deep anti-authoritarian streak in this great country. And whatever he did talk about, or whenever he did talk about American exceptionalism and made fun of it, I'm sure if it had been pointed out to him that if he had tried his act in, let's say, China or Yugoslavia or Cuba, it wouldn't have ended well for him. So I think his act is a testimony and a testament to America itself that we produce such brilliant, brilliant satirists and comics like George Carlin. And born on May 12, 1937, humbly in the Bronx, New York, raised by his mother, his parents divorced when he was 2 months old. The long hours the mother worked left the young George by himself. By the way, that sounds very familiar. That was Al Pacino's life. He raised himself, and he ended up talking to himself and doing scenes by himself, providing him time he needed to think about various subjects. Again, all the time we spend as parents hovering over our kids, and look what happens when this kid's left alone. He listened to the radio a lot, and he practiced impersonations. Here, George Carlin himself talks about those early years and what would become his major influences in the world of comedy.
I was lucky that I grew up in the golden age of radio and the golden age of television, because the late part of radio was the best and the early part of television was the best, and I had them both. And radio, of course, is a commonplace to say that it left everything open to the imagination because it was just words and you could form your own pictures. 1943, I'm 6 years old, and I'm beginning to get up and down Broadway on my own. The theaters along Broadway, the movie theaters then, and a few of them featured older movies that were in re-release. Suddenly there was this spate of Horse Feathers and Duck Soup and all the Marx Brothers movies, and I began to see them, and the anarchy of that. That's the fact that they could go through a hotel lobby, light a couch on fire, take a man's toupee off, and that all people did was go like this, you know. They weren't arrested or grabbed or anything. They would run. They were chased maybe by one guy. So that appealed to me, the just sheer nonsense and the uprooting of norms.
The uprooting of norms, and nobody did that better than Groucho and his team of merry men. Carlin attended parochial school, and much of his negative religious sentiment stems from his experience as a Roman Catholic and as an altar boy. Here in one of Carlin's stand-up routines, he talks about this particular time in his life.
I used to be Irish Catholic. Now I'm an American. You know, you grow. Yeah. I was from one of those Irish neighborhoods in New York, one of those kind of parish schools. Wasn't typical. It was Corpus Christi was the name of it. Could have been any Catholic church, right? Our Lady of Great Agony. St. Rita Moreno. Our Lady of Perpetual Motion. What's the difference? What's the cause? You know. The church part and the neighborhood part were typical, but the school was not. It wasn't one of those old-fashioned parish kind of prison schools with a lot of corporal punishment and Sister Mary discipline with a steel ruler, right? Oh, my hand! Oh. And you'd fall 2 years behind in penmanship, right?
Well, he's behind in penmanship, Mrs. Carlin. I don't know why.
Well, he's crippled. He's trying to learn to write with his left hand. You know?
And by the way, the remarkable thing back then is Catholics loved Carlin. And we used to be able to make fun of each other, critique each other, joke about each other. It was a different country. It was a different time. Live and let live. And every once in a while, laugh about yourself. It's okay. You'll survive. We had a lot more confidence then. Carlin completed 2 years of high school before dropping out in the ninth grade. Again, we hear that story over and over. The great geniuses in this country, mostly self-taught. We'll do Irving Berlin soon. Never studied music. Could only play the black keys. That's it. Couldn't read music. And what a life. In 1954, at age 17, he enlisted in the U.S. Air Force as a radar technician and was stationed at Shreveport, Louisiana. Over the next 3 years, Carlin moonlighted as a disc jockey at a local radio station. In 1959, Carlin teamed up with Texas newscaster Jack Burns. The pair collaborated on a morning radio show in Fort Worth before relocating to Hollywood. Here's Carlin talking about this important transitional part in his life.
Jack Burns was a newsman. He and I roomed together with a third guy and found we had a great comic affinity. And we found we had this ability to improvise. And for the 4 months I was there, because I had to leave there, unfortunately, before I had planned, Jack and I split up and didn't see each other and didn't think of anything of it. I wound up in Fort Worth with a good rock and roll job.
How you doing? George Carlin here, inviting you to become a member of our big swinging KXOL teen club. Big contest, big prizes, big fun for you and all of Fort Worth teenagers.
Jack showed up there on his way to Hollywood to be a star, and there was a news job just opened up that day, and he took it. We developed the act there, and 2 months later, we decided to leave radio and drive to Hollywood in my new Dodge Dart Pioneer two-door with the tinted windows and the AM/FM. And we drove to Hollywood, and, you know, we took that fabled American trip west, and it worked.
And it worked. Again, only in America. No education. The boys get together, get in a car, drive out west, and take a chance. And what a talent. When we come back, more from George Carlin himself, more of his act. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. This day in history, George Carlin died. American Stories, and today we're celebrating the life of comedian George Carlin, who died this day in history in 2008. As always, our This Day in History segments are brought to us by Hillsdale College, the only and best place to study things like the Constitution and the letters of great writers going back to the ancient Greeks, straight through to the moral philosophers that helped found this great country. And if you can't get to Hillsdale, Hillsdale can get to you. Their great online courses, which you should rip any family through, can be found at hillsdale.edu. And if there was anybody that epitomized free speech in this country and the First Amendment and epitomized what we mean by believing in such things, it was Carlin, who stretched it as far as it could be stretched and left no one unscathed. And that was the joy of this man. Everybody hated him and everybody loved him. And he didn't care. So now we're going to go back and take a listen to more from Carlin's own mouth. We love to do that here on Our American Stories. Enough about us. And by the way, over the 50 years that Carlin was performing, 14 HBO specials, featured in dozens of movies and TV shows, wrote several books, won the Mark Twain Prize Award for American Humor, along with 4 Grammys. Not bad. So here, Carlin goes on one of his famous rants about environmentalism. While Carlin had some extremely liberal points of view, his take on this topic probably isn't what you'd expect.
We're so self-important. So self-important. Everybody's going to save something now. Save the trees. Save the bees. Save the whales. Save those snails. And the greatest arrogance of all, save the planet. What? Are these people kidding me? Save the planet? We don't even know how to take care of ourselves yet. We haven't learned how to care for one another. We're going to save the planet? I'm getting tired. I'm tired of Earth Day. I'm tired of these self-righteous environmentalists, these white bourgeois liberals who think the only thing wrong with this country is there aren't enough bicycle paths. People trying to make the world safe for their Volvos. Besides, environmentalists don't care about the planet. Not in the abstract, they don't. Not in the abstract, they don't. You know what they're interested in? A clean place to live. Their own habitat. They're worried that someday in the future they might be personally inconvenienced. Narrow, unenlightened self-interest doesn't impress me. Besides, there is nothing wrong with the planet. Nothing wrong with the planet. The planet is fine. Do you ever think about the arithmetic? Planet has been here 4.5 billion years. We've been here, what, 100,000? Maybe 200,000? And we've only been engaged in heavy industry for a little over 200 years. 200 years versus 4.5 billion. And we have the conceit to think that somehow we're a threat? That somehow we're going to put in jeopardy this beautiful little blue-green ball that's just a-floating around the sun? The planet has been through a lot worse than us. Been through all kinds of things worse than us. Been through earthquakes, volcanoes, plate tectonics, continental drift, solar flares, sunspots, magnetic storms, the magnetic reversal of the poles, hundreds of thousands of years of bombardment by comets and asteroids and meteors, worldwide floods, tidal waves, worldwide fires, erosion, cosmic rays, recurring ice ages, and we think some plastic bags and some aluminum cans are going to make a difference? The planet isn't going anywhere. We are. We're going away. You want to know how the planet's doing? Ask those people at Pompeii who are frozen into position from volcanic ash. How the planet's doing. Want to know if the planet's all right? Ask those people in Mexico City or Armenia or 100 other places buried under thousands of tons of earthquake rubble. If they feel like a threat to the planet this week. How about those people in Kilauea, Hawaii, who build their homes right next to an active volcano and then wonder why they have lava in the living room? The planet will be here for a long, long, long time after we're gone, and it will heal itself, it will cleanse itself, because that's what it does. It's a self-correcting system. The air and the water will recover, the earth will be renewed, and if it's true that plastic is not degradable, well, the planet will simply incorporate plastic into a new paradigm, the earth plus plastic. The Earth doesn't share our prejudice towards plastic. Plastic came out of the Earth. The Earth probably sees plastic as just another one of its children. Could be the only reason the Earth allowed us to be spawned from it in the first place. It wanted plastic for itself. Didn't know how to make it. Needed us. Could be the answer to our age-old philosophical question, why are we here? Plastic.
And there you have it. And again, whatever your orthodoxy, your ideology, watch out. Carlin's about to offend you. And again, in this age, harder to make a living if you're George Carlin. Maybe not even possible. In this clip, Carlin tackles a topic that we talk about often on this show. The ridiculous notion that every child deserves a trophy.
The child will never lose. We know he'll never lose because in today's America, no child ever loses. There are no losers anymore. Everyone's a winner. No matter what the game or sport or competition, everybody wins. Everybody wins. Everybody gets a trophy. No one is a loser. No child these days ever gets to hear those all-important character-building words, "You lost, Bobby." "You lost. You're a loser, Bobby." They miss out on that. You know what they tell a kid who lost these days? "You were the last winner." A lot of these kids never get to hear the truth about themselves until they're in their 20s. Now, all of this has grown out of something called the self-esteem movement. The self-esteem movement began in 1970, and I'm happy to say it has been a complete failure. Because studies have repeatedly shown that having high self-esteem does not improve grades, does not improve career achievement, it does not even lower the use of alcohol, and most certainly does not reduce the incidence of violence of any sort. Because as it turns out, extremely aggressive, violent people think very highly of themselves. Imagine that. Sociopaths have high self-esteem.
Terrific. And finally, here are some of Carlin's famous rantings about people's modern obsession and fear about germs.
What we have now is a completely neurotic population obsessed with security and safety and crime and drugs and cleanliness and hygiene and germs. There's another thing. Germs. Where did this sudden fear of germs come from in this country? Have you noticed this? The media constantly running stories about all the latest infections, salmonella, E. coli, hantavirus, bird flu. So now everybody's running around scrubbing this and spraying that and overcooking their food and repeatedly washing their hands, trying to avoid all contact with germs. It's ridiculous, and it goes to ridiculous lengths. In prisons, before they give you a lethal injection, they swab your arm with alcohol. It's true. It's true. It's true. Well, they don't want you to get an infection. And you can see their point. Wouldn't want some guy to go to hell and be sick. It would take a lot of the sportsmanship out of the whole execution. You can't even get a decent hamburger anymore because everybody's afraid of food poisoning. Hey, where's your sense of adventure? Take a chance, will you? You know how many people die in this country from food poisoning every year? 9,000. That's all. It's a minor risk. Besides, what do you think you have an immune system for? It's for killing germs. But it needs practice. It needs germs to practice on. So listen. If you kill all the germs around you and live a completely sterile life, then when germs do come along, you're not going to be prepared. And never mind ordinary germs. What are you going to do when some super virus comes along? You're going to get sick, you're going to die, and you're going to deserve it because you're weak and you got a weak immune system.
And the response to Carlin, he's tapping a nerve as he always did. Political correctness in the end is what he was always after. Carlin had a history of cardiac problems spanning decades. He twice underwent angioplasty to reopen narrowed arteries. In 2005, he entered a drug rehab facility for treatment of addictions to alcohol and Vicodin. He died on June 22, 2008, in Santa Monica, California. On this day in history, the great George Carlin died, and we celebrate him on Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and now it's time for our Beginning Again series. Stories of folks beginning again in their lives, and from all types of things. Beginning again after a divorce, a job loss, retirement, the loss of a loved one. Everything and anything. Americans have a unique capacity to begin again, to renew, to start again. We want to hear from your Beginning Again stories. Give us a call at 844-627-8255. And record your 2 to 7 minute story there, or leave us your information and we can help you record it. Once again, that's 844-627-8255. Beginning Again is hosted by Beverly Willett, a former New York City attorney who's now a writer. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times and the Washington Post, among many other publications, and she had her own Beginning Again story right here on this show several months ago, after her husband pursued an office romance and left the family. And by the way, it's a story you can listen to in the Beginning Again topics section on our OurAmericanNetwork.org website. And by the way, talk about beginning again. She picked up from her brownstone in New York City, gave up that legal career, moved to Savannah, Georgia, of all places, and started up as a writer. That's what I call beginning again. And this week, Beverly brings us the beginning again story of a young woman named Amanda. Amanda did not want to give her last name. And by the way, we're often not interested. We want to protect people's anonymity and yet at the same time allow them to share their stories with you. In fact, these are the people I like the most. They're not looking for the attention. I just think they want to get the story out. Take it away, Beverly.
Before we talk about your beginning again story, Amanda, maybe you can just tell us a little bit about your early childhood, what happened with your parents, and how you came to be living with your father and then eventually into foster care.
All right. Well, when I was young, the earliest thing that I can remember is my mom and dad would fight a lot. I remember my dad constantly drinking, and they eventually split up. Also, when I was younger, one of my early memories was when my mom and dad did split up, my dad went back to live with his parents. And, of course, I would visit there on the weekends. And at a young age, I was sexually assaulted by my grandfather. It started at the age of 5, and I don't really remember too much throughout the period that the sexual abuse was happening, except for the sexual abuse. And then about 9, 10 years old, I finally had enough. My mom wanted me to go live with my dad full time, and I didn't want to because of what was going on. And when I told my mom, everybody just kind of shunned me away. So my mom really didn't want to have nothing to do with me. Nobody believed me. And my dad was then living in a car, which was where I went because he was the only one that took me in. And we stayed in a car for a long time in Rochester, Michigan. I was taken away from my dad not much longer after that because we were found sleeping in the car behind a restaurant, and the cops came and took me away and put me into foster care. And I went through a bunch of different foster cares, and really the only one that came to see me in my foster care was a girl that my dad had been dating.
And you hear that nervous laugh, and I guess Amanda's laughing because the only other option would be to cry, and she's cried enough in her life. After being shuffled around in foster care placements, Amanda is emancipated and out in the streets at 16 years of age and alone. Let's rejoin Beverly's Beginning Again feature with Amanda.
I looked for love in a lot of boys, and then they brought me to drugs, and then drugs brought me to other drugs, and it felt like the people who that were there for me were the ones that were hurting me as well.
So eventually, I think you told me that you became addicted to crack and you were arrested. You spent some time in jail. And then I know you said that you were on probation and didn't meet your probation obligations and landed back in jail for a while. And then there came this moment I think you told me where, I remember this very vividly, when you said you were about to get released from jail. Mm-hmm. You were in your 20s, and you didn't want to go. You didn't want to leave jail.
Nope.
Tell me about that. I mean, because for most of us, we would say, okay, we want to get out. But for you, there was this moment that you said, no, don't let me go.
Yeah, when that time came, there was a drug counselor at the jail that I was at, Miss Hart, and the chaplain. And they had told me my release date was coming up and stuff, and I told them, if they let me go, I'm going to die. Because I already knew, you know, I already knew if they let me go, I'd have nothing, and I would end up right back where I started. And, you know, I was around some really, really bad people. And I had already heard what happened to a couple of the other girls that I was out there with. And so I just didn't want to die.
What had happened at this point in your life that made you sort of realize this and be scared to leave and not want to?
Hearing the girls that I used to hang out with were dying. Knowing that I didn't want to die. I didn't want to live like that. I don't want to be a statistic. I don't. I have too much to offer for myself and for my family now. And I knew I didn't want to die. Everybody around me that I was with was dying. I knew that I just didn't belong here. I was just not. Something hit me. It's hard to explain.
Actually, we get it. And when we come back after the other side of this break, you're going to hear the rest of this story. And we'd like to bring you every kind of story. You know, she had said at one point to Beverly that she didn't want to leave prison. If you remember, we did that hour on Merle Haggard. And Merle had spent so much time in prison that he confessed that the most lonely time he had ever experienced in his life was the 3-day, 4-day period after coming out of prison. Because he was so comfortable there. It was the outside world he just didn't understand. And he was lonely. When we come back, more in our Beginning Again series, thanks to writer Beverly Willett. And we'll hear more from Amanda after these messages. This is Our American Stories. And last segment, we heard the first portion of Beverly Willett's latest Beginning Again feature. And again, to catch our first, go to OurAmericanNetwork.org. Listen to Beverly's, because it's quite a story. And this brings us to the story of a young lady named Amanda. Again, she didn't want to give her last name, and now we're beginning to understand why. And my goodness, so many lives like this. We learned it a little bit during our National Adoption Month. We spent some time on foster stories. And, oh my goodness, whose parents divorced when she was a little girl. She was then sexually assaulted by her grandfather at 5 years old. At one point, she lived in her dad's car, then went from one foster care placement to another, and at 16 years old, was emancipated and thrown into the streets alone. where she found love in all the wrong places, in boys and drugs, ended up in prison, which she just told us she didn't want to leave because she didn't want to go out into the streets and die. That's the rock bottom of a life, folks, the rock bottom feeling it took to bring Amanda back to life. Let's now continue with Beverly Willett's Beginning Again feature with Amanda.
I've heard people talk about like this kind of aha moment when all of this stuff kind of like comes to the forefront of our head and we suddenly have that moment. Did you feel that these, because I know that I have, before I spoke with you, I had spoken to someone in the jail, and we don't want to get into names here. You're entitled to your privacy. But this particular law enforcement officer is the one that told me about your story, and he just spoke about you in such glowing terms, and as one of the people, you know, that he put right up there as this is a woman who's really gone through things that most of us can't even begin to imagine and turned her life around. And we saw her wanting the help. And at that moment, I guess, you know, you were reaching out and they saw you reaching out, and something happened in that moment to bring you both together.
Yeah. I guess you can call it an aha moment, or or God was reaching down on me and smacking me in the back of the head and is like, it's time to wake up, because I begged. I really did. I begged, please don't let Al stay here longer. I don't care what you do to me. Just don't let me go.
So what happened?
They didn't let me go. The jail paid for me to go to a drug treatment facility, a women's residential. Within that women's residential, I learned how to live. I learned how to love myself. A lot of people say that you're born addicted. To me, my personal experience, I was born addicted to love. I searched so hard for that love that I did not care where it took me. I really didn't. And in that women's residential, I learned in order to get that love and to love, you have got to love yourself. And I met my husband over there where I was at in the city where I was living in. And now I'm married and I have a beautiful daughter. And in my addiction, I had other kids. And I now communicate with my 16-year-old daughter. And I'm very grateful for the life, grateful for that aha moment. Without that moment, I don't think I'd be here.
And wow, what words. I learned how to live. I learned how to love myself. And when she said, I was born addicted to love, I searched so hard, I didn't care where it took me, that search. So let's rejoin Beverly in this final portion of her Beginning Again feature. And again, here's Amanda.
There's something interesting when I've talked with you, and that, you know, I think you have plenty of things that in your life you could blame other people for, because you got off to a real rocky start. You got off to such a rocky start that most of us can't ever imagine and don't go through. And, you know, it's almost like, who could blame you? My gosh, nobody can blame you for this. But to not come out of it feeling resentful, I've never felt that from you. I've never felt an edge of resentfulness. How is that possible?
I'm not really sure. And I don't know where it comes from, but I will tell you that I have a good relationship with my real mother. And I have a relationship with my father. My father and I aren't on the best of terms, but I love him, and I go and see them once a year, and I take my daughter with me. I honestly think that seeing how my husband's family is has helped me to forgive, because they love me no matter what. And they're awesome. And I, without them, I don't think I would be able to have the relationship I do with my mom. And I don't think I'd be able to have even a little bit of a relationship with my dad. And before my grandfather, who sexually assaulted me, passed away, I didn't forgive him face to face, but I did it, you know, with my higher power. And I went and seen my grandma before she passed away, and I took my daughter to go see her. So it takes a lot, but I can't blame anybody else. All I can do is fix me, and that's all I did. I didn't worry about them, because if I didn't forgive them, I would not be where I'm at, because I would have been filled with so much hatred. But just, it was hard. But my husband's family has really helped me a whole lot.
A final note here. I know that you are also, in addition to being a wife, a mom, and reuniting with your family, you are also an aspiring baker.
Yes.
So tell us your favorite recipe.
My favorite recipe? I just recently at my job did the most beautiful coconut cake, and I've never done one. It's like a four-layered coconut cake. it was awesome, and the baking makes me feel I get out of myself. I'm able to use my hands and make something beautiful out of nothing.
Well, thank you, Amanda. And you had no idea that coconut cake is my absolute favorite. I'm telling you the truth. Thank you for being with us today and sharing your amazing Beginning Again story.
No problem. Thank you.
And joining us now live on the line is Beverly Willett. And Beverly, thanks so much for that story. It was just terrific.
Oh, I just loved hearing it again, because I just get a smile on my face just listening to her laugh. It makes me so happy.
And that forgiveness, the power of forgiveness, my goodness. We're going to be doing a half hour on Louis Zamperini soon. And my goodness, there's a life where forgiveness made everything possible. You know, you guys have such, you ladies have such different backgrounds, but yet you suffered tremendous loss and grief. As different as you were, did you feel some similarities there, Beverly, as well?
I mean, I did. Just talking with her, you know, I feel like we know each other, and I feel a real closeness just talking to her. But, you know, these Beginning and Again stories, I mean, I think the one thing that unifies them all is that none of us in our lives is immune to hardship and tragedy. And I think when we can find those, we can realize that, we can find a common bond that helps us to heal each other. It helps us to empathize with each other. And, you know, just obviously our stories were completely different, but we both had these aha moments, I guess, as Amanda said, where they were sort of turning points in our life. When we realized that we wanted our futures to be different and that we did not want to continue to hold on to the suffering that was holding this beautiful life that we could both have back. So I think that was a similarity, despite the fact that, you know, I had plenty of advantages that Amanda never had.
Yep.
So I think there were similarities.
There were. And that's the point of this, I think, in the end, Beverly. And we look forward to the next Beginning Again feature. Thanks for this work on Amanda. And soon enough, we'll have you back on the air again. Beverly Willett, And the subject, the subject is Beginning Again. Thank you, Amanda, for joining us. And this is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And please, if you have stories of your own, don't hesitate to give us a call at 844-627-8255. Leave your name, leave your number. We'll take care of turning it into a story. Just get in touch with us. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. There are some days we don't do any of these days in histories, and there are others we are compelled to do too. And today, well, that's one of those. This is one of those days. And in this hour, who is Pete Maravich, a.k.a. Pistol Pete? Well, some of you know, and I know then you can't wait to hear the rest of this. But for those of you who are basketball fans and don't know him, and those of you who don't like basketball at all and don't like sports, well, this is still a great story. And so let us begin with this simple question that I just asked. Who is Pistol Pete?
Excitement, enthusiasm, greatness. That was Pete Maravich.
He was unstoppable. It was as if you had melted down all 12 Harlem Globetrotters, and then filled up this skinny 6'6 white frame with everything they had.
Everything just stopped. It was like, wait a second. Did he just do what I think he did?
You were never quite sure what he was going to do with the ball in the open court, because he had 1,000 moves to either shoot it or pass it.
Give him that much room and he'll burn you.
He faked with his right hand like he was going to the player on his left, and he just whiffed it, and then he hit it, tipped it with his left hand to the player on his right. He went in for a layup, and the officials called traveling. And Pete went crazy. He went to the official and said, "You can't call that. You've never seen that move before."
Nobody handled the ball better than Pistol, but he wasn't just satisfied with that. He had to put a little show on for the fans.
I asked him once if he'd ever played a perfect game. He said, "No, but I'm going to. So some night I'm going to take 40 shots and I'm going to make them all."
He was an entertainer at heart, and his ability to pass the ball and dribble the ball and do outlandish things on the court, which sometimes even overruled the game, that was Pete Maravich.
And Pete Maravich was born on June 22nd, 1947, in a small steel town in western Pennsylvania. His father, Press Maravich, was a local basketball hero himself, who logged a short career as a pro. Press's skills became the foundation of his son's greatness.
When I was 7 years old, my dad sat me down and he said, "Pete, if you'll listen to me, you might be able to get a scholarship in basketball, because we can't pay your way. And maybe you not only get a scholarship, but maybe you'll go to the pro level. And you'll play on a team that wins a world championship. And you'll make $1 million playing basketball. And they'll give you a big diamond ring and it'll have your name on it and say world champions." And to a seven-year-old, my eyes lit up. And I said, "Dad, that's what I want." He said, "If you let me teach you, you just commit. You dedicate your life to basketball and that's all you have to do. And you'll live happily the rest of your life." And that's what I did. I became a human basketball. I was a basketball android.
And that he was. There's always those great clips of seeing Pistol Pete walking down a street, twicking that basketball on his finger. And you knew he slept with the ball. He was the ball. Pete's father knew exactly how to pull his son's heartstrings. Let's take a listen.
Pete would come on the court in the backyard and say, "Let me shoot. Give me the ball." And Press would say, "No, go back in the house. You're too small." And Press said on one occasion he'd left the ball on the court and went back in the house and looked back through the kitchen window, and he saw that Pete had slipped onto the court, picked up the ball, and started shooting. And Press says, "I knew at that moment I had him."
It was like his dad was dangling something out in front of him and would intrigue him, and Pete would get interested in it, and then his dad would take another step and then another step until he was hooked and he was obsessed by the game of basketball.
When he was 12 years old, he opened the window to his room, jumped out of the window, and spent the night in the woods cuddling a basketball. When Press was at the wheel of the car, Pete would sit in the back seat by the window, put the window down, and as Press drove slowly, Pete would dribble the ball. Now, I mean, that's an eerie connection with basketball.
You bet. And according to NBA.com, when Pete was only 11, get this, he made 500 consecutive free throws one evening after school. Try that. Just give it a shot. See how long it takes you to make 500 straight. Like, forever. And he stopped only when it became too dark to see the rim that was illuminated only by his father's flashlight. In 1956, the Maravich family moved to South Carolina, where Press would coach Clemson's basketball team. While Press built a reputation in the ACC, Pete was building one of his own, playing on the high school varsity team as a 12-year-old.
In 1959, he threw a pass between his legs, and the crowd went berserk. It was a small crowd, but they went nuts. And at that time, something clicked in him, very much like any entertainer.
When practice was over at high school, he would stay another hour or two just ball handling and shooting hook shots from half court, stuff like that. He was about 5 foot, weighed about 80 pounds when he was in the eighth grade. He used to sit out there from 20, 25 feet, shoot from the hip. That's when he got that pistol name.
Pete was always the last one to leave the court, and when Press would be there to pick him up, he would say, "Well, come on, Pete," and Pete would always put him off. "Dad, I've got a little bit more to work on. You know, I've got something else I need to do," and Press would look at me and he'd say, "How about that kid?"
When I knew him in high school, he was this jittery, jerky kind of a guy, the kind of guy that, probably some psychologist today would have him on Ritalin. You know, he was probably just too jerky. He couldn't concentrate. He couldn't sit still.
Trying to be friendly to Pete was kind of hard because he would start looking down and moping around. He wouldn't really care, in particular if there were girls involved.
And after high school, Press Maravich presented he and his son as a package deal to the college that would put forth the best offer. Press chose LSU, fulfilling his dream of coaching his son.
I can remember the first day I saw Press Maravich at a press conference at LSU, the first one he had as a coach. And before he got halfway through, he said, "Boy, there's going to be a guy next year at LSU is going to be the greatest basketball player in the world, my son Pete."
Now, as you can imagine, if you know anything about the SEC, selling basketball in a place like LSU, well, that's just funny. I mean, football in Death Valley, in that stadium, that's religion itself, practically, as close as one can get. When we come back, how Press and Pete turn LSU into a basketball powerhouse and put LSU on the map for hoops, not football. More on this day in history, celebrating the life of Pistol Pete Maravich. You won't believe the rest of this story. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And this day in history, Pistol Pete Maravich was born in 1947. And as one of the commentators had said early on in last segment, Pistol Pete Maravich was all of the Harlem Globetrotters wrapped into one human being. And it's true. Well, back to the story. It was an almost impossible feat back then, as I had indicated, to sell basketball in a place like Louisiana and LSU. But with Pete, anything was possible.
It wasn't until Pete showed up on campus and started playing that, I mean, it was like the word spread like wildfire that here was a bona fide superstar.
And it'd be 5,000-6,000 people would show up at a freshman game just to see him. And then they'd have the varsity game and it would be like 600-700.
And that was Jim Carville, by the way. You know him from his political commentary. He was also an LSU alum. After averaging 44 points on a freshman team that lost just once, and again, I said 44 points, that was his average day, Pete joined his father on the varsity team in 1967, where he dominated the league and filled stadiums with enamored fans. But receiving his father's approval was what Pistol Pete craved most of all.
Those of us that were close to Press could tell how proud he was of Pete. And behind Pete's back, he would just say glorious things about Pete. He would never tell Pete that he was that great. Part of what Pete was searching for was his father's approval, and I don't think he got it very often.
And it's interesting, withholding some of that approval and love made him strive more. And I'm not saying that's what we should do as parents all the time, but sometimes perhaps we shower our kids with a little too much praise. And finding that right balance, I think that's what we all struggle with. While Pete and his father interacted on the basketball court, his mother, Helen, well, she struggled with the crowds and rarely went out in public.
The sad thing about that was when she was in public, she was just absolutely marvelous. A wonderful lady, but she just, I think, crawled within herself.
Well, his mother was an alcoholic. I don't think anybody identified that problem at the time. Nobody talked about that problem at the time. But you could put things together.
You could. And Pete himself, well, he struggled with alcohol as well.
He would wake up in the morning to go to class and go out there and see how did he get his car in this spot. You could almost sense and feel him hitting the front bumper and then backing up to the back bumper and front bumper and back bumper until he gets in.
He drank a lot when he was in college was the reports we were getting, a couple of wrecks. And, of course, you know, Daddy wasn't going to kick him off the team, but he might bat him around a little bit.
Yeah, I don't think people laugh about that quite as much, but that was, those were the days. That's what happened, and that was pretty routine. However hard Pistol Pete played off the court, he never let up once the whistle blew, averaging 44 points in his sophomore and junior years. But scoring was only part of Pistol Pete's arsenal.
We felt like his ball handling and his assist abilities overshadowed his scoring abilities. And that sounds crazy when a guy averages 40-some points a game. So we made the decision that we were going to play him straight up and guard the heck out of the rest of the people.
Coach Rupp didn't think that Pete could beat us all by himself, and so we would play him one-on-one. The six games that we played against each other in college, I think Pete averaged over 50 points a game. But we won all six games, so Coach Rupp was right.
Coach Rupp, by the way, of the powerhouse Kentucky squads. And imagine that, 50 points a game against one of the great college basketball teams of all time. In late January of 1970 against Ole Miss, and we broadcast from Oxford, Mississippi, home of Ole Miss. It's just about an hour south of Memphis. The Pistol passed Oscar Robertson's NCAA scoring record. That senior year, he also broke his own season record by averaging 44.5 points a game. He finished his college career with an NCAA record 3,667 points in only three seasons. Because again, back then, NCAA rules at the time prohibited first-year students from playing at the varsity level. To this day, he still holds 11 NCAA records, including the all-time leading NCAA scorer, with career averages of 44.2 points per game over a three-year career. That's just crazy. All of his accomplishments were achieved before the three-point line shot and the shot clock were introduced to the NCAA basketball system, and despite being unable to play varsity again as a freshman under NCAA rules. So just imagine what he could have accomplished. Let's take a listen.
Well, what I do every year in my first notes column of the year is I just remind people of what Pete Maravich did, that he averaged 44 points a game for three seasons. And I don't think people understand what that number is, and that's a number that will never be approached ever again in college basketball.
I think without a doubt he was the greatest offensive player ever to play the game. If you want to break his record, that was with no three-point shot. All you have to do is score 15 three-pointers every game you play your entire college career, and you'll break Pistol's record. No one's ever going to do it.
As college's all-time scoring champion, though, Maravich would face a new challenge, and a new challenge in the National Basketball Association.
We are most happy to announce that Pete Maravich will play professional basketball for the Atlanta Hawks.
As the third pick in the 1970 NBA draft, the Atlanta Hawks made NBA history by presenting the richest contract ever offered to a college player at 5 years for $1.9 million. But not everyone was happy with that deal.
Here's a white kid who hasn't played a day as a pro, making more than triple the salary of anyone else on that team. And it caused some dissent.
You think? Yeah, the vets probably weren't too happy. Despite his national following and a 24-point average, Maravich wasn't adding wins. The Hawks never won a playoff round in his four seasons there. The Hawks' GM at the time was Pat Williams, and he was approached by head coach Cotton Fitzsimmons about Maravich's game, his drinking, and his temperament. Here's Pat.
Cotton came to me at that point and said, you know, we got to start thinking about making a move here. Well, I started doing that very quietly, and, you know, it was very, very interesting. There was no interest.
There was no interest. Maravich was eventually picked up by the expansion team, the New Orleans Jazz. Pete was finally going home. Here again is Pat Williams.
Pete then says, what did you get for me? And I told him, trying not to be too elated, but I reeled off the picks we were going to get, laid the whole package. And there was a little pause, and Pete said, is that all?
Is that all? And then in 1974, Helen Maravich was pronounced dead from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. She was 49. Here's Pete's friend, Calvin Murphy.
I saw a difference after his mother passed away. I saw a difference in Pistol. I saw a serene, almost kind of a lost individual. It was all the pressure that was placed upon him that wanted to chase him away from the game. He didn't know if it was worth it anymore.
And Calvin Murphy himself was a heck of a ball player for the Houston Rockets. Maravich averaged 21 points and 16 assists in his first season with the Jazz. It was the first season he made All-Pro. He averaged 33 points in 1977, and the Pistol could still deliver showtime performances. Both guns were blazing on February 25th, 1977, against the New York Knicks.
He just went off that night. It was the most amazing thing I'll ever remember seeing as a player.
Pistol fire! Oh, come on! Come on! 68 for Maravich!
68 for Maravich. That game is bettered by six other players only in NBA history. Battling a bad knee, Maravich was waived and picked up by the Boston Celtics, where he finished his career in 1980. That final year would be the rookie season for his fellow Celtic teammate, Larry Bird. Unfortunately for Maravich, his last year would be the first year the three-point line was instituted, a line from which he shot 66.7%. Maravich was 33, and the next couple of years without his passion, the fame, and his identity, it would be sheer torture.
According to Pete, these were the darkest 2 years of his life. He basically holed up in the house. He was incredibly depressed, and he spoke about it as if he was a drug addict going through withdrawals. And the withdrawal was the attention and the love that he had for basketball.
But Pete Maravich was about to be released from his demons. How he gained his freedom surprised all who knew him. In 1982, the depressed and lost son of a basketball father found someone else to believe in.
Pete Maravich believes that God spoke to him audibly. And he said that from that day on for the rest of his life.
And I was getting ready to go off my bed, and God spoke to me. He spoke to me audibly, and he said, be strong and lift thine own heart. It reverberated through my room. I'll never forget it as long as I live, just like I'm speaking in this microphone. He was not in my spirit. He was outside. He had not come in yet.
And that's the voice of Pistol Pete Maravich, and he had found Christ. And when we come back, the rest of this remarkable story, Pistol Pete, born this day in history. And if you ever catch the 30-30 that ESPN did on him, just the video alone will just make you laugh. More after these messages. This is Our American Stories, the life of Pistol Pete Maravich, celebrated here on Our American Stories. I wanted to go back to that last clip. There was more to it we had to cut out because we were heading towards a break. But, you know, as we had said, Maravich was about to be released from his demons, and he gained his freedom, well, from a surprise place. No one expected it. Let's return to that clip and take a listen.
Pete Maravich believes that God spoke to him audibly. And he said that from that day on for the rest of his life.
And I was getting ready to go off my bed, and God spoke to me. He spoke to me audibly, and he said, be strong and lift thine own heart. It reverberated through my room. I'll never forget it as long as I live, just like I'm speaking in this microphone. He was not in my spirit. He was outside. He had not come in yet.
God spoke to us personally. And a lot of people can't understand that. I don't understand it. But he spoke to us audibly.
I'm saying, come on, Pete. He says, oh, I promise you, Bob. I was woken by a sound. It was the Lord speaking to me. And at that time, he dedicated his life to the Lord.
He found that, and he was more devoted to that than anything I've ever seen, basketball included.
Once he became a Christian, he would read his Bible hours at a time, every day.
He would go up and talk with anybody then, where before he thought everybody was coming to talk to him all the time. And he was always trying to convert somebody to Christianity.
Pete helped guide his own father to Jesus, who died of cancer in 1987. Here is Pete reflecting on his father just after he died.
My dad was really my hero. I mean, he influenced me so greatly in my life, and he influenced me until the day he died. We were very, very, very close, and I think that's good. I think a father and son should be that close. I think the heroes today should be the fathers. They should not be some athlete. You can admire athletes. You can admire rock stars. You can admire people. But it should be the fathers that are the heroes of kids today. And I think most kids like to be like their fathers.
And then 9 months later, Pete himself would follow his father. On January 5th, 1988, Pete was scheduled to be interviewed with Dr. James Dobson on his Christian radio program, Focus on the Family, while playing pickup basketball at the church's gym in Pasadena, California. Something terrible happened. Here's Dr. Dobson and his colleagues who were witnesses that day.
I knew that he had really come through a difficult time in his life, and there'd been a dramatic change in his life when he met Jesus Christ, and I really wanted to hear him tell that story, but I had not met him until that morning at 7 o'clock when we met at the gym to play basketball. I think he was going about half speed, but there was a move or two that he made that took our breath away.
We played about three games, and at that time, some of the guys went to get a drink of water, some went outside to get some fresh air, and before I knew it, it was just Dr. Dobson and Pete on the court, and I was underneath the basket rebounding for Pete as the two of them talked.
He said, you know, I've loved being here today. He said, I've really got to get back into basketball, even if it's pickup stuff like this. And I said, how do you feel today? And I promise you, his last words to me were, I feel great. I just feel great. And I turned to walk away, and I don't know why, but I looked back at him for some reason, just in time to see him fall. And he fell hard. He didn't break his fall. I mean, his face hit the boards.
I walked over very carefully along with Dr. Dobson, thinking that Pete was going to jump in our faces, but as soon as we got close, we could see his eyes rolling back and the color in his face starting to change.
And then I saw that he was in a seizure, and I got down over him, and I held his tongue and kept his air passage open for about 20 seconds. And then he just writhed once like that. His body moved once, and he was gone. The man died in my arms.
Maravich was 40. He left behind his wife Jackie and their two sons, Joshua and Jason. In 1996, Maravich was named one of the 50 greatest players in NBA history. While Joshua and Jason were there representing their father, Magic Johnson approached Maravich's two sons and confessed that he borrowed the term Showtime from Maravich and said that, quote, he was the real Showtime. Here's NBA Hall of Famer Elvin Hayes, followed by Pistol's brother, Ronnie.
Most artists, when they are living,
people don't recognize them and recognize their great talent until after they're gone. And I think this is what really happened to Pete Maravich.
It seems like to me everybody wants to dwell on the sad times or depressed times. He had a good life. He had a great life. He did what he wanted. He played basketball. That was his love. Then he ended up with his second love, his wife. And then he had his kids. And then he found Jesus. I think he died a happy person. If he was alive today, he would probably be walking down Bourbon Street handing out leaflets for Jesus. If he got one person out of 1,000, he'd be happy.
Yep, that sounds like Pistol. He was like a great singer with a style all his own, a pacing that was different, a flair for the unusual, said Los Angeles Lakers legendary announcer Chick Hearn. NBA great Paul Westphal said this. He was an artist. His canvas was the court, and his brush was the basketball. And NBA legend Elgin Baylor declared, quote, Jerry West was the best I ever played with, and Pete is the best I've ever seen. Here's another NBA legend, Bill Walton, reflecting on the Pistol and the no three-point line while he was in college.
Amazing about Pete, 44 points per game career for three straight years in an era with no three-point line. Dale Brown, who coached at LSU after Press and Pete were there, Dale Brown went back and charted all the games with the running score. You know, Maravich free throw, Maravich 22-foot jumper, Maravich layup. And he calculated that with the current college three-point rule at 19.9, Pete Maravich would have averaged 13 three-point makes per game, which would have given him a career average of 57 points per game under today's rules. That guy is unbelievable. We love him. We missed him terribly. What a great friend. What a great human being.
The late Pete Maravich.
In his 2005 memoir, Chronicles, Volume 1, Bob Dylan wrote this about Pete Maravich. Quote, and imagine this, Bob Dylan writing about Pistol Pete. I started and completed the song Dignity the same day I'd heard sad news about Pistol Pete. I'd seen him play in New Orleans once. He was something to see. Mop of brown hair, floppy socks, the holy terror of the basketball world. High-flying, magician of the court. The night I saw him, he dribbled the ball with his head. Scored a behind-the-back, no-look basket, dribbled the length of the court, threw the ball up off the glass, and caught his own pass. He was fantastic. Scored something like 38 points. He could have played blind. Pistol Pete hadn't played professionally for a while, and he was thought of as forgotten. I hadn't forgotten about him, though. Some people seem to fade away, but then, when they are truly gone, it's like they didn't fade away at all. And we're going to leave you with that song from Bob Dylan.
Fat man looking in a blade of steel. Thin man looking at his last meal. Hollow man looking in a cotton field for dignity. Wise man looking in a blade of grass. Young man looking in the shadows that pass. Poor man looking through painted glass for dignity. Somebody got murdered on New Year's Eve. Somebody said dignity was the first to leave. I went into the city, went into the town, went into the land of the midnight sun. Searching high, searching low, searching everywhere I know. Asking the cops wherever I go, have you seen dignity? Blind man breaking out of a trance, puts his both hands in the pockets of chance, hoping to find one circumstance of dignity.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And now and then, we love to throw to Jesse's favorite segment, and he brings this to us when he feels like it. Let's take a listen.
Shower thoughts.
People shouldn't be allowed to use the bathroom on an airplane for flights lasting under 2 hours. If you can't hold it for that long, too bad. I'm sorry your mommy didn't teach you any self-control. I'd like to think that money wouldn't change who I am, but when I'm winning Monopoly, I become a terrible person. If organized crime started printing high-quality counterfeit college textbooks and then sold them at cut-rate prices, it'd be a really good public relations move. If pigs could fly, I bet their wings would taste delicious. When boarding an airplane, first-class passengers are forced to sit at eye level with the coach passengers' crotches as they board. Airlines could solve this problem by letting first-class board last. Sometimes pets are better than children. They eat less, they don't ask for money, and if they get pregnant, you can just sell their babies. Dog food could say it's any flavor it wants to. You're not going to test it. When I was a small kid, my grandma used to show me love by playing along with my make-believe games. Now that she's older and has dementia, it's my turn to show love by playing along with hers. If you accuse someone of being argumentative, they can't disagree with you without proving your point. Why would anybody buy a bookmark for a dollar when they could use a dollar for a bookmark? According to most ghost photos, our clothes must have a soul too, otherwise all ghosts would be photographed naked. The kind of people who close the shade on an airplane window should be placed on the terrorist watch list and not be allowed to fly. These people are the last kind of soul-sucking vampires I would want to die with if, God forbid, the plane went down in flames over the sun-scorched desert. Shouldn't billboards be illegal since they distract you from the road? If you wash the dirt from a fallen ice cube, you're washing your water with water and hope that there's only water on the water that you will add to your water.
Shower thoughts.
Well, thanks for that, Jesse, as always. And next, we're bringing you Melissa Fenton, who runs the website www.fourboysmother.com. As you might guess, Melissa is a wife and a mother of four boys, and writes humorous and heartfelt essays about modern parenting and nostalgia. We've all heard about that tragic accident at Disney World, where two parents enjoying a vacation with their kids suddenly and violently had their world torn upside down when an alligator took their two-year-old boy in front of their very eyes. The father suffered numerous wounds as he fought a losing battle for his young, helpless son in the alligator's clutches. The mother even ran to help and also suffered wounds. Tragically, in the end, the young boy was not saved. And the day after the accident, Melissa Fenton penned a fantastic essay, Open Letter to Perfect Parents, Put Down Your Pitchforks, that went absolutely viral. And, well, she recorded it for us. Let's take a listen to Melissa's poignant rant that rivals some of Hengler's very best rants.
Parents, I beg of you, stop blaming and shaming other parents. 35 years ago, a mom, shopping in a Sears department store, went to go look at lamps and left her 6-year-old with another group of boys who were all trying out the new Atari game at a kiosk. That boy's name was Adam Walsh. 30 years ago, an 18-month-old toddler playing in her aunt's backyard fell into a well. Rescuers worked nonstop for 58 hours, finally freeing baby Jessica from the well. In both cases, a tragedy happened. An unforeseen tragic accident took place which left Adam dead and a toddler fighting for her life deep underground. But they also had something else in common. They had an entire country of moms and dads supporting the grieving parents. Let me repeat that. Everyone supported the rescue efforts without blame. No blame. None. Zero. No questions asked. Not one single, where were their parents? Comment. Just a country of other moms and dads, grandmas and grandpas, watching in horror as a set of parents, one of their own, went through the unthinkable. Adam was everybody's son, and Jessica was everybody's daughter. Those parents were us. Flash forward to 2016, the year of the perfect parent. Yesterday, a two-year-old boy splashing in the magical lakefront waters of a Disney resort succumbed to the wilds of Mother Nature. An aggressive alligator scooped him out of the water right under the watch of his father, who attempted to fight with the alligator to free his baby son. Pure horror. Sheer terror. Parents who actually had to watch their baby be taken from them as if they were in some African nature documentary. A tragic and unforeseeable accident. An accident. I weep for this mother and father. I am sick with anguish for the pain, agony, misery, and regret pulsing through their veins this very second. And I bet you are too. But not everyone is. You see, we now live in a time where accidents are not allowed to happen. You heard me. Accidents, of any form, in any way, and at any time, well, they just don't happen anymore. Why? Because blame and shame. Because we have become a nation of blamers and shamers. And how are accidents allowed to happen if we can't blame someone? Surely they can't, right? I mean, random acts of nature, unpreventable tragedies, and fateful life-changing events that take place in a matter of nanoseconds cannot possibly take place if everyone is being a responsible parent. Right? Nope. They can't, because this country and its population of perfect pitchfork-carrying mothers and fathers sitting behind keyboards needs to accuse. They need to blame, to disparage, to criticize in every damn way and at every damn corner the parenting of another. And when do they really get to lick their blaming chops? When a tragic accident happens. That's when the pouncing is at its freshest. When raw emotion and ignorance collide, and they dig their word claws in and take hold of whatever grace these grieving mothers and fathers have left in their souls, and they tear it out. Listen to me very carefully, perfect parents. Very carefully. I've had enough. I've had enough of scrolling through comment threads and seeing over and over again questions like, "Where were the parents?" And thoughts like, "This is what happens when you don't watch your kids." I've simply had enough. I have one question for the blaming and shaming moms and dads. You know, the ones who immediately blame the parents. The ones who go on the internet and type comments like, "This is nothing but neglect by the parents." And, "They should have known better. Who was watching that little boy?" And my personal favorite, "I would never let that happen to my kid." Here's my question. Have you ever been to a child's funeral before? Because I have. The funeral of a child is an event in life that you never, ever want to experience. Now let me ask you another question. In the coming week, these parents will fly back to their home in Nebraska without one of their children. They will leave a vacation resort, packing up his Buzz Lightyear pajamas and his favorite blanket, and they will make an excruciatingly difficult journey home. A journey that they never in a million years thought they would be making. They will meet with a funeral director, pick out a tiny casket, a tiny burial suit, and surrounded by family, they will bury their baby boy, and they will suffer every single day for the rest of their life. At the funeral for this two-year-old boy who died in front of his parents, can you do me a favor? Can you walk up to that mother and say the words that you just typed out last week? Can you? Can you greet her, hug her, shake the father's hand, and then say, "Who was watching that little boy? You should have known better. I would never let that happen to my child." Can you do that for me? I mean, you felt those words so deeply in your heart and soul that you typed them for a million people to read. Certainly, you can say it straight to the faces of the people you meant it for. Right? Here, let me help you. Put away your pitchfork for a moment and try this. To the mother and father who went for a walk and vacation for the last time with their little boy yesterday, I am deeply sorry that you had to experience the worst kind of tragedy possible, an accident. I grieve with you. Your baby was my baby. Your son was my son. I have nothing but love for you. Love to help you get through the pain yesterday, today, and for what is going to seem like 1,000 tomorrows. I wrap my thoughts and prayers around your aching heart and soul. May the God of this universe, in some miraculous way, bring peace to you and your family. That is what you say. That. And just that. Stop blaming. Stop shaming. In their darkest hours, can we please just love other parents? Please?
And that was Melissa Fenton, author of An Open Letter to Perfect Parents. Put down your pitchforks. Couldn't agree more. That's why we ran it. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And if you want to hear more of our content, more of our storytelling, go to OurAmericanNetwork.org. That's OurAmericanNetwork.org.